Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The most comprehensive criminal justice reform bill in decades has passed the Massachusetts legislature. That happened yesterday to very little opposition. Now, law enforcement officials had pushed back hard against some of the original proposals in the bill, but the final piece of legislation seems to strike a compromise between rolling back some of the harshest sentencing minimums and fines, while also cracking down on certain drug penalties and expediting DNA testing in criminal cases. Now, the bill passed 37-0 in the state Senate and 148-5 in the House. Governor Charlie Baker has yet to say if he'll sign the bill, but his office says the administration will, quote, carefully review the final legislation. Now, we spoke earlier with Middlesex County District Attorney Marion Ryan on the compromises made in the bill, and we asked if she likes the final version.
I do. I mean, I was an early supporter of the Senate bill, and I think that what we've accomplished this year is a real testament to the work of the legislature and also to the collaboration across the disciplines. You know, it's important to keep in mind that we do criminal justice reform in Massachusetts about once every 20 years.
Right.
This is a very sweeping bill, and to have it in a place where, as you said, there's pretty much agreement with where we are is a very significant step for the Commonwealth.
You know, I'm seeing here that State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz is calling this a huge turning point for the state regarding criminal justice. It sounds like you'd agree with her.
I do agree with that, yes.
Okay. So I'm curious, though, do you think that the bill does strike the right balance between justice and safety?
I think that that's always the balance that we are looking to strike, and that folks have worked very hard. Can you always do more? Yes, you always could. But in terms of getting folks together, bringing people to the table, I've been incredibly impressed this year with the really high level of discussion and respect that the players have shown in getting to this point.
Yeah. So is there anything, though, I mean, to be frank, is there anything that's still in the bill that concerns you?
Well, the devil is always in the details. I think that with many of these pieces, it's going to be a question of working it out, of staying on top of things to see that they're actually happening, putting the funding in place to have what's envisioned by the bill.
Okay. What about specifics around things like changes in rules around fentanyl, for example?
Well, you know, the fentanyl piece is obviously the car, specifically with respect to car fentanyl, the bill requires a knowing distribution of a mixture of car fentanyl. So that's going to be challenging. But I think that the piece of legislation reflects the concern that everyone has with the fentanyl and car fentanyl. I mean, that is literally what is killing people right now. That's where we're seeing the increase in fatal overdoses. So we do have to address that, and we'll work through making decisions about those cases and then have them obviously addressed by the court.
Yeah. So one major change that this bill is trying to make is to reduce or in some cases eliminate mandatory minimum sentencing in Massachusetts. But around fentanyl, though, if I'm reading this correctly, it still does have some mandatory minimum. So I'm seeing some people here saying, well, on the one hand, we're getting rid of some mandatory minimums, but on the other hand, we're introducing them from fentanyl. They're concerned that there's a possibility that people suffering from drug abuse may get caught up in the mandatory minimums around fentanyl.
I think what's significant about this bill is we've had mandatory minimums for a long time. This bill goes pretty far in eliminating some of those mandatory minimums. It doesn't go as far as the original Senate bill in eliminating all of those. But it is a sea change, really, in the way people are seeing the difference, as you outlined it, between those people who are suffering from addiction and those who are actually profiting. I think it does reflect the growing concern that folks have. And, you know, the families who suffered the devastating loss from fentanyl or carfentanyl. And that is what is killing people right now, you know, literally thousands of people across the Commonwealth. And the decision was to really keep in place those harsher penalties with respect to those drugs.
I'm also seeing here that the bill would authorize DAs to divert people away from criminal sanctions. Can you tell me more what you think about that?
Well, that won't be a big change for us
okay.
in Middlesex and
yeah.
for many other offices because we have very robust diversion programs. This bill does a lot to address some of the collateral consequences for people who get involved in the criminal justice system addressing their fines or the loss of a driver's license, that sort of thing. But everyone is better off if you can prevent people having to get involved in the criminal justice system to begin with, particularly younger offenders.
Right.
So this really just kind of standardizes what many of us have in place, the diversion programs that help. The goal is to change the trajectory of someone's life, to figure out what the issue is, whether it's substance abuse or mental health concerns or other things, channel them to the right place to get treatment and avoid them being, you know, having the constraints of a criminal record.
So this is a really important point, and it's actually a place in which I think some criminal justice advocates are saying the bill may fall short, right? Because John Larrivee, who's president of Community Resources for Justice, points out, it's a quote from him, on the one hand, we have a criminal justice reform package that's pinning its hopes on the goal of recidivism reduction. At the same time, we've seen programs, including some of the ones that he works with, that focus on reentry close. I mean, is there still something of a disconnect between saying that we want to have a bill here that reduces recidivism, but not necessarily providing the financial supports to help do that?
Well, that's one of the things I was talking about earlier. I mean, I think the challenge for us now that, you know, assuming that the bill makes it out of the governor's office, is going to be how do we pay for this and how do we keep it moving forward? I mean, for instance, one of the pieces that I've been very involved with for the last 4 years that's contained in the bill is the use of restorative justice programs. You know, there's a wonderful result with these programs. They're incredibly important. And this now offers them as an option to folks across the state the same way we do in Middlesex. But that is going to cost money. And, you know, we're going to have to work with our legislative partners to continue to fund those kind of things. Because you're right, having a program in the bill doesn't really change someone's life if we can't afford to pay for it.
And finally, is there anything that you think is missing from the bill or that you would have liked to see?
I think you could always think of things. You know, there were obviously things in the original Senate bill that didn't make it here. But I really think this is a significant moment for the Commonwealth in terms of criminal justice. And it really reflects a growing sophistication in terms of how we look at a number of issues and a real commitment to helping people to move forward from a mistake or something that's happened and get their life back on track.
And I'm just curious, there may be some people listening to this right now who do see this as a soft on crime piece of legislation. Do you think that there's any merit to that, or what would you tell them?
I think that you have to look at this bill as a whole and also look at it against the backdrop of the other statutes that we have in place. And I think that when you look at that and look at how this addresses primarily some of the collateral consequences and what do we want when someone's been held accountable for their actions, the goal is obviously to get them back to work, get them in housing, get them back into society. And this bill goes a long way towards doing that.
Well, Marian Ryan is the district attorney for Middlesex County. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. You're welcome. Take care. Bye-bye.
Let's get another take on the criminal justice reform bill. Joining us now is retired federal judge Nancy Gertner. She's also WBUR's legal analyst and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, it's good to see you again.
Good to be here.
Okay, so we're going to talk about this criminal justice reform bill, everybody, with Judge Gertner, I promise. But we actually have a little bit of breaking news here, also in the world of Massachusetts criminal justice. And that's because the Supreme Judicial Court, Justice Frank Gaziano, has ordered for the dismissal of more than 11,000 convictions in 7,600 cases that were tainted by former state chemist Sonia Farrick. He made that decision today. Folks will remember that Farrick pleaded guilty in 2014 to stealing drug samples and using drugs while working at the state drug lab in Amherst. Now, the Committee for Public Counsel Services, the ACLU of Massachusetts, had called for the dismissal of every case tainted by Farrick and her, quote, subsequent years of prosecutorial misconduct. They had called for that last fall. Last month, the CPCS and ACLU expanded their call to include all drug convictions arising from the Amherst lab during Farrick's tenure there. Okay, but today the decision from the SJC is 11,000 convictions in 7,600 cases dismissed. Judge Gertner, what do you think?
Well, it's about time. There was no reason why there were any meaningful distinctions between what had happened in the Boston cases involving Annie Ducan and this. In fact, in many respects, the Farrick case was much worse because this was not, this woman was consuming the drugs. And in addition, it raised profound questions about the workings of the Amherst lab in toto. So while I welcome this, and it was clear that the court had to take a stand, it's troubling that the prosecutors didn't dismiss more. It's troubling that this couldn't have been done immediately. There was really no other way but to dismiss these cases.
Okay. But the judge also said, the justice, I should say, said that there was prosecutorial misconduct here. I mean, is that something that still needs to be handled?
Well, there continues to be, I believe, a case involving two assistant attorneys general who misrepresented
Indeed.
To the court
right.
about the evidence in the case. And so arguably that's one of the reasons why this didn't happen immediately, because there was misconduct in not disclosing it. You have to step back from this over and over
yeah.
again and say this is not sophisticated DNA analysis. This is not, you know, fancy challenges to shaken baby syndrome. This is the de minimis requirements of a laboratory, which is to give accurate drug testing. And the notion that there was any reluctance on the part of the Attorney General's office, on the part of the DA's office, to see this through is extraordinary.
Right. And also, just once again, when we consider the volume of cases we're talking about here, right? I mean, some 7,600 cases, 11,000 convictions today that Justice Gaziano dismissed. In Annie Duquesne's case, it was 20,000, right, that
right.
were thrown out just this past summer.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess what we come back to again and again, though, is, can or should your average Bay State resident feel confidence in the criminal justice system, or in the drug labs, at least, in the state now?
Well, I think, you know, it's an interesting question. I mean, one question is there had been an effort to put together a forensic science commission and a commission to oversee all of this, which, as I understand it, is not part of this bill and has not succeeded. So, you know, you have to the issue is not just remedying what happened yesterday. The issue is remedying it going forward, to see what can be done going forward. And I don't know what's going forward, but it seems to me the citizens of Massachusetts should not feel comfortable unless we have figured out a way to prevent this from happening in the future.
Oh, okay. Well, so let's go to the steps forward that the legislature has taken regarding the criminal justice reform bill. Again, just to remind people, it passed overwhelmingly in both the Massachusetts House and Senate. And Governor Baker's office says he's going to take a close look at the final bill, but hasn't yet said word if he's going to sign it or not. But, you know, it's interesting, Judge Gertner, because we heard Middlesex DA Marion Ryan a couple of minutes ago saying that in this state we only get a reform package like this every 25 years or so, which says something in and of itself. But my thought is, then we better get it right if we're only going to do it once a generation. Is this one, did they do it right?
Well, I think that there are a lot of good things in this bill, and I think there's a lot of things to be done. And I hope she's wrong about every 20 years. I mean, I've written about the fact that the irony here is that in liberal Massachusetts, in fact, we were way behind on numbers of fronts in criminal justice, in part because of Willie Horton, who famously killed someone on furlough, and this was in 1980. And to some degree, that horrendous crime shut down criminal justice reform over the next 20 or 30 years. So this is, on the one hand, this is a very important effort, and there are many things in this bill which are really quite remarkable and about time. On the other hand, one would hope that this is not the end of the discussion. For example, there's a section on juveniles 18 to 21.
Yeah.
And there's a study commission. The legislature was unwilling to raise the age in which individuals who are accused of crime in that age group would go through the juvenile justice system. Other states have considered that. The neuroscience points in that direction, but they wouldn't do it this time, but called for a commission to study it. Commissions can study it until they're blue in the face. The fact of the matter is that the legislature has to bite the bullet and deal with this age group. 80% of the men that I sentenced when I was a federal judge were in that age group for drug offenses. We have to deal with that age group. It is, on the one hand, the age group that is the easiest to, whose problems are complicated on the one hand, but who in fact will grow out of those problems if we don't mess it up.
Okay, but if in the case of what you saw from the bench, 80%.
Yes.
That's the overwhelming majority.
Overwhelming majority, yes.
So what is the right way to deal with it? You're not talking about, like, shunting them out of the criminal justice system entirely, are you?
No, not at all. I mean, it's a question of understanding, not subjecting them to lengthy terms of imprisonment. It's a version of what the SJC did with, you know, not allowing life without parole for juveniles. Yeah. That was under 18, but there's a question in that range as well. What you do can be more, as the fancy word is, criminogenic. You can make them worse criminals by what you do in that period of time. If someone completes a program within that age range, do you want to make sure that their records are expunged? In other words, we know that that is a period of time of change, when the brain is substantial fluidity in the brain, and that there will be changes that you want to make sure you do not make impossible for the rest of their lives.
Okay.
So I would, that's a flaw in the bill. I want them to look again at the 18 to 21 year old group.
I see. So because, I mean, you wrote an op-ed in the Globe last summer saying that 19 year olds don't belong in adult prisons.
Right.
But this bill, to be specific, it doesn't raise the age of those who count as juvenile offenders to 18.
Right. We were asking for a small step.
Yeah.
The bill was asking for a small step, which was going at least to 19. What they did is they raised the age of individuals who could go through the juvenile justice system from 7 to 12. So you can only charge someone even at age 12, which was a good thing. But the other end they didn't address, and they called for a commission. A commission is a good thing, but there has to be the political will to address this.
Okay. So there's a couple other big sections that I want to talk to you about, because we just spent a bit of time there on juvenile justice. But this idea of changing a lot of the mandatory minimums, minimum sentences, I should say, in Massachusetts, eliminating some, entirely changing others. This is something that a lot of criminal justice advocates have been calling for a long time. But at the same time, we do see the bill have certain mandatory minimums for example, crimes related to trafficking fentanyl and carfentanil. So I just kind of want to ask you a big 30,000-foot question here. We're getting some changes on the one hand, but new mandatory minimums on the other hand. So does that signify to you a change in perspective in the state about whether or not mandatory minimums are the right way to go?
Not clear. I mean, okay. On the one hand, we have to sort of look at what's a mandatory minimum. It's saying that judges cannot be trusted to make distinctions with respect to certain kinds of crimes, which does not make any sense. There's an appellate process. There is a transparency with respect to the press as to what judges do. So the notion that you need any kind of mandatory minimums is really quite extraordinary. Plus, there was a problem with mandatory minimums, which is a prosecutor has the ability to determine the sentence by the charge.
Right. So you basically, what you're saying is you would like to see mandatory minimums whatsoever.
That's right.
But that is not what we have here.
That's right. But I mean, there are certainly, they eliminated many of them, non-opiate, non-weight retail drug offenses. Many of them were eliminated. I don't think that this is the right response to opioid trafficking, especially given the complexity of opioid trafficking, which is it oftentimes, the addicted person oftentimes begins with prescribed medication. The overdoses are oftentimes people sharing drugs, and so you don't know who did what. So given the complexity of opioid trafficking, I would not be in favor of mandatory minimums here.
Okay. So one more sort of major part of the bill that I want to touch on with you, and that is they put the bill writers, the legislature, let's just put them as a whole because it passed with so many overwhelming numbers. The legislature puts a significant amount of effort in trying to craft a bill that would help reduce recidivism rates in Massachusetts.
Right.
And we have a little bit of tape here from Norwood Police Chief William Brooks. He's skeptical that making it easier, for example, for low-level offenders to expunge their criminal records, which is one feature of the bill, he's skeptical that would have any significant effects on recidivism rates. So here he is.
There's two sides to it. I understand the idea that if a person can kind of get rid of minor mistakes they've made in the past, that it might help them get a job. I understand that. By the same token, we have a very strong Corey law. And most employers don't get a full Corey when they're going to hire someone. So it remains to be seen exactly what impact that has.
Okay, so Judge Gerner, I mean, do you think this bill is going to be effective at reducing recidivism?
I take a page from what Marion Ryan just said. Only if the diversion programs are funded, only if restorative justice is funded. The mistake that we may have made in, 20 years ago before mandatory minimums were in vogue was that we wanted to rehabilitate people and never gave judges the tools with which to do that or correctional facilities with which to do that. It's great to say, I'd like you to be rehabilitated, but if you don't have a job and you were kicked out of school in the 10th grade, you walk away from this and you don't have the tools with which to change your life. So expungement is one thing, and I agree with your previous speaker, with Sergeant Brooks, Captain Brooks.
Chief Brooks.
Chief Brooks, sorry. I agree with what he said. The expungement alone doesn't do it, but you really got to work to change lives. And prison obviously doesn't. So what you have to do is other programs, and if they don't fund the other programs, this won't make a difference.
Okay, so last quick question. I'm going over time here, as I always do, but last quick question. You're doing great, Judge Gertner. This has got to be a million times easier than anything that you faced on the bench here. Okay, but to get back to your earlier point, really, I think a lot of people are calling this a major criminal justice reform bill in Massachusetts because they don't come along that often. But you've already identified several areas here that you wish to see further improvement on. But I mean, it seems like a lot of people are just like going, we got this one done. We may not see another one for several years. Concerned about that?
Yes, we have to make sure that that doesn't happen. The bill has compassionate release, which is great for older prisoners, which is a wonderful thing. It also does some regulation of solitary confinement, but solitary confinement still exists. So there are good things, but we should not be content until we have real reform, until Massachusetts once again is a leader in criminal justice rather than an also-ran.
All right. Well, Nancy Gertner is a retired federal judge, WBUR's legal analyst, and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and she got away this time without me asking her about Stormy Daniels. So, Judge Gertner, it's great to see you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.